Washington Post Live's Futurist Summit, The New Age of Tech, is presented by Mozilla.
You're listening to a podcast from Washington Post Live, bringing the newsroom to you live.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us at Washington Post. I am Elahi Azadi, a media reporter and the co-host of the Post Reports podcast. And I'm thrilled to be here joined with my colleagues. We're joined on stage by Sarah Ellison, to my left, a National Enterprise reporter. Pranshu Verma, he is an innovations reporter. And Kat Sakreski, who is a national technology policy reporter. Thank you three for joining us.
Thank you.
Yes. As we saw, this is a very important year. And Kat, I wanted to start with you. Maybe it's easy for those of us in the United States to think about 2024 being a pivotal year, but actually, this is a year in which nearly half of the global population will be going to the polls. And actually, just on Monday, Secretary of State Blinken warned of a, quote, flood of falsehoods that could suffocate serious civil debate during this pivotal year. So I wanted to first start and ask you to dig in a little deeper into what makes this year so different than prior election years. Not just the fact so many people are going to the polls, but what is the landscape that people are going to the polls within?
Well, so I think there's three things that make this year really different. The first is scale. The tech companies have cut their trust and safety teams that are responsible for combating disinformation, but at the same time, they're dealing with more elections around the world than ever before. And so that creates a real tension within the companies about where do you place your resources in order to protect democracies. The second is conservative backlash. We've seen a series of lawsuits from Republicans who are concerned that efforts to fight misinformation within the government amount to censorship of their views. And that has really had a chilling effect on a number of government and civil society efforts to address misinformation. And the third, I would say, is the tech. We've been talking all day about artificial intelligence.
Right.
And that creates a host of new challenges.
Yeah, it's like the tech is evolving so quickly at the same time that all these other social and political dynamics are taking place. And you mentioned misinformation and disinformation. And Pranshu, I wanted to ask you about the idea that misinformation during election years, that's not new. I mean, that's something we saw in 2016, 2020. And I'm curious what makes it distinct this year, and also disinformation, which is, I don't know if you would call it this, like I think of it like a cousin to misinformation.
Yeah.
It's not the same. So what examples have you seen lately of this?
Yeah, I think we're still figuring out what the broad scale impact is of, for example, artificial intelligence, like Kat mentioned. But we are already seeing some very clear examples that yes, AI is better, and it's better able to clone your voice, your image, your entire likeness. But what's happening is that there are really cheap and really easy tools that anyone can now create a deep fake. And so we're seeing specific examples like we just talked about. There was the robocall of President Biden urging voters not to vote ahead of the New Hampshire primary. And then if you look abroad, there were examples in Moldova. There was a liberal party politician, and she was deep faked to say that she supports a pro-Putin party ahead of an election. Now, if you go to Bangladesh, a conservative Muslim country, there was an opposition lawmaker that was deepfaked to be in a bikini, right? Obviously trying to get at some cultural issues there. And then, of course, in Slovakia, right, there were people that were on a faked audio, a politician talking about rigging the price of beer, right? Raising the price of beer, clearly something that voters would give a lot of care about,
yeah,
right?
Very like, controversial.
Yeah, like, I mean, if you want to deepfake somebody
there
out of a career,
yeah,
tell them they're going to raise the price of beer,
oh,
right?
It's a
like,
wrap.
That's
yeah,
freaking really genius.
Yeah.
But none of these are like, this isn't some massive campaign that is orchestrated that we know of by some nation state actor to sow discord, where it could be. Oftentimes, it's a lone political operative. It could be a rogue individual, or we're not sure. It could be a teenager that's just bored and then can post this stuff. And if it's savvy enough and it's timed well enough, we can see that actually it's hard to fact check it in the moment. Where systems are not built to fact check it in the moment. And are the companies able to like hold to their promises and stop the ability for political propaganda to be made through the tools that they create. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I want to get back to that point of whether the tech companies are equipped this year to deal with this. But as you were talking, it made me think, and Sarah, I wanted to ask you this, it made me think about the promise of social media and a lot of this technology was to democratize information and actually help democracies around the world. And I mean, we can talk about the Arab Spring and how lasting that effect like that was, but the it feels like the promise of social media was to be in support of democracy and create democracies. And I know that you and our colleague Naomi Nix reported recently about how big tech is actually surrendering to disinformation. So it raises this question of what impact actually these companies and these platforms are having to undermine democracy. And can you explain how we got there from the promise that was there to the current conversation we're having today?
Sure. I mean, Kat touched on two big points, which was that there were these mass layoffs earlier where people really gutted their trust and safety teams. And so the people whose job it was not to accumulate new users. I mean, there are lots of, these are big companies and there are lots of different teams. The people who were responsible for policing this kind of thing were really eliminated from the company. And then there was this massive pressure campaign where people, where right-wing and conservative politicians were saying, this isn't misinformation, this is my belief. This is something that I legitimately believe. So why is it that you're why is it you're censoring me? Mm-hmm. And then the last thing that we really found in the peg for our story was actually when Elon Musk bought Twitter. He sort of opened the Overton window in social media to say, we're going to allow all these things that had been previously disallowed. Come back in. You can, I mean, specifically, he was like, you can misgender people. You can do all of these things that previously would have gotten you suspended from the platform. And what that just means is that at this point, these social media companies all decided to kind of retreat from this effort because they didn't want to be the quote unquote arbiters of truth. That was sort of a famous quote from Mark Zuckerberg. So now what we have is, you know, the idea that misinformation isn't new, it's really in the bloodstream. People really believe certain things. And so as a social media company, they don't want to be in the position of policing those beliefs. And they've really backed away from some of these efforts that will, in fact, let, you know, democracy can thrive on social media and anti-democracy can thrive on social media at the same time.
Right, right. That makes me wonder about, Kat, I'm wondering about the incentives, too, for these tech companies to tamp down on misinformation and disinformation. If the incentive is to have a profitable business, or what incentives are in place to make sure that these sorts of pieces of data content aren't spreading, like the deepfakes that Pranshu was mentioning, and if actually the incentives are misaligned there.
There have been many criticisms that the incentives are horribly misaligned with social media and misinformation because these types of videos that go viral on the platform that might be false can cause people to spend more time looking at Facebook, looking at TikTok, and at the end of the day, they are trying to get that type of engagement in order to boost their own profits. Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things to watch as we head into this election season is what role advertisers might play in putting pressure on the companies. We have seen in the past at heated moments, if you think back to the 2020 election or when Elon Musk bought Twitter, where the advertiser said, hey, we don't want our ad to appear next to these lies about the election or hateful content. And so I'm closely watching this year what role they might play again.
That's interesting because in some ways reflects some of the things we've seen in traditional media and especially broadcast media in the wake of the 2020 election of advertisers pulling back. But that's a totally different business model because they rely on fees from cable companies and that sort of thing. Pranshu, going back to and picking up on this conversation around deepfakes and AI generated, fake content, it's creating this environment in which politicians are more easily able to dismiss something that's real as fake. It's sort of altering our perception of reality. This has come up with former President Donald Trump. I believe there was a recent example of that with him. So have you seen other politicians around the world take that similar approach? Is this the same sort of, the fake news 2.0 of being able to dismiss things that are actually true, like a politician going up and giving a speech and saying, this has been manipulated and fake.
Yeah, this is kind of like my favorite rabbit hole to go down. And Drew Harwell, a wonderful tech reporter, told me the term is called the liar's dividend.
The liar's dividend.
Okay. I love it as a concept. Yeah. But like you mentioned, I do not love it in actuality.
Okay, good.
But as a concept, also, just on the record. but as a concept, it's really fascinating because you mentioned former President Trump. There was an ad generated of him by the Lincoln Project of real gaffes that he had made on the campaign
trail.
And
the Lincoln Project is an anti-Trump organization.
Exactly. And these were real events that happened. Reporters were there covering it. Mm-hmm. This got mainstream coverage. And his response was, this is AI generated. Right? So like imagine in 2020, the Access Hollywood tape breaks, Trump's grabbing a woman by genitals, and he has the excuse to say, that wasn't real, that was AI generated. Right, and so what happens is it offers a very potentially potent excuse to dismiss away real damning information that comes out about you. Because like we were saying, like, you know, you used to be able to trust that you could hear something or you could see something and then that something happened. But now with AI getting better, there's this kind of, convenient and cozy excuse here. And we've seen it abroad too, in Taiwan, ahead of their elections, there was an opposition party lawmaker that was seen to be depicted going into a hotel with a woman that wasn't his wife. And so the opposition lawmakers kind of rallied around him to say, no, that's an AI deepfake. That actually wasn't. We don't know if it's true. We don't know if it's an AI deepfake. But what we know now is that there's a question about the truth of it. And then it's the same thing in India happened, where there was an audio deepfake, potentially an audio deepfake, of a politician of the ruling party saying that there was a $1 billion scam that he was a part of. Again, the excuse was, well, no, that's an AI generated piece of audio. And yet none of that, it dismisses away the scrutiny enough that you're now finding a repetition of this type of excuse coming through. And so it kind of gets to that point of like muddying the waters of reality and kind of dismissing and easily allowing you to kind of play with the concept of truth.
And I think that that's actually probably going to be in this election cycle, one of the biggest one of the biggest things. It doesn't really, I mean, yes, it's going to matter how good the deep fakes are, but once people start to believe or not believe what they're seeing, or just to create the doubt,
exactly.
Say like, well, we don't know if it's true or it's not true. People can throw up their hands and say, well, they're all lying, or they're all, like, there's this sense of, you know, the way people are going to receive this is just to kind of zone out and say, you can't believe anything.
Right. It almost mirrors the way that the traditional press or the more mainstream press was villainized in previous election cycles as well, right? That you can just sort of throw your hands up or like, well, I don't know what to believe.
These aren't reputable. Or I certainly don't believe these reputable people because they're disreputable now and I've been told not to believe them. And so the if you're looking for a touchstone as a voter, it's much harder to find one.
Well, it's interesting because in the introduction, we saw Meta's Nick Clay, Google's Sundar Pichai, and OpenAI's Sam Altman. They were all saying that they want to be part of the solution, not part of the problem when it comes to election deepfakes specifically. But given what we were talking about, a lot of these tech companies have gutted these teams that dealt with a lot of the misinformation and making sure that at least what's on their platform isn't totally false. That those safeguards aren't there, or those safety rails aren't there the way they were before, and it's now the technology is advancing so fast. So is the cat almost out of the bag? Where how can these tech companies do anything to control this problem at this point?
I mean, I would be interested in what you guys think, but it seems like theoretically the technology would be there to identify, in most cases, a deep fake, but the will to do that, also what exactly constitutes a deep fake that needs to be policed.
That's a philosophical conversation.
I mean, and these companies have lots of different priorities. If you want to show, you know, a deep fake of Joe Biden drooling or of Donald Trump, I mean, some of that you could say that's political satire. We're just, you know, it's like a cartoon, and then you have a whole debate about whether or not that's an appropriate use of AI. And you would have, I'm sure that Meta and all those companies would be debating that at the policy level. And we've seen them sort of fall down and be really susceptible to political pressure when it comes to those questions. They are companies, they want to make a profit, and they want to stay out of controversy.
Yeah. There's one other company we haven't talked about or platform, and that's TikTok.
It's probably the most, yeah.
Yeah, and I want to ask you this, Kat, that there are, you know, roughly, give or take, 150 million Americans on TikTok. It's a huge number. Maybe you're not on it. Maybe your mom is on it. My mom is on it. I think moms and teenagers are on TikTok. Big populations of people are on TikTok. And then, you know, Congress, the House of Representatives, just passed a bill that could lead to a ban on TikTok. And I'm curious about the power of TikTok within politics to shape our politics, because there's also been reporting that Trump's allies have told him and have counseled him that going against TikTok would hurt him politically. Meanwhile, we do have the White House and President Biden backing this effort. So what is the power of TikTok right now in our politics?
So TikTok's power has only grown in our politics with every election cycle. It's become more and more popular. And as you just mentioned, this initially was looked at as an app that was just for teen dance crazes. But now you have moms, you have significant voting blocs that are spending time on TikTok. So that makes it more important for campaigns. And I think it's putting politicians in a really tricky spot. Mm-hmm. We're seeing this with the Biden administration right now. President Biden's campaign has joined TikTok, and they've made videos there. They've also developed partnerships with TikTok influencers in order to promote their policies. But at the same time, we see, you know, this growing concern about the app's ties to China and politically a need to show we're tough on China, we're going to take a stand against this app. And so you see these politicians kind of weighing both sides of that coin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because at the same time, I don't know if you saw, we're tracking this, but when this bill was being debated in Congress, the app had these pop-up messages where users were being told to contact their representatives and members of Congress. Their offices were being flooded with all these calls, and it's also putting them in this, I wonder if this is a year where that, more than Meta, more than X, is going to be the topic of conversation among politicians and to be put on the spot of where they stand. I don't know, Kat, if you're already seeing indications of how this is going to play out.
We are seeing that. I mean, I was talking to congressional aides that day that the pop-ups were going out, and they were saying, we have to shut down our phone lines because we're getting so many calls about TikTok. And so we know that this is an issue that motivates young voters. I think, you know, even dating back to more than a year ago when the House of Representatives was having hearings on this, the Secretary of Commerce came out and said, this is a sure way to lose voters under the age of 35 if we support this legislation. And so I think the Trump campaign is realizing that, and that's, you know, why we've seen them back away from some of the rhetoric we heard in 2020.
Right. Pranshu, I wanted to also bring up a piece of reporting that you've done as well, a series called Rising India Toxic Tech, and that detailed the vast campaign online, the digital campaign by Hindu nationalists to stoke conversation and discourse in India. If you had to sum up what your big takeaway is walking away from that reporting and what you found, and also given the Indian election is upon us as well, how do you expect AI to be involved in that country's politics?
Yeah, the Rising India series, which was led by our bureau chief Jerry and Joe Mann and Karishma Mehrotra, Anand Gupta, and some more, it was a pretty broad scale finding that the Bharatiya Janata Party, which is the ruling party in India, which Modi heads, is uniquely adept at using social media and artificial intelligence to sow discord. There is content that is hateful. There is content that targets minorities. There is content that is blatantly lies and propaganda. It comes in vast amounts, and there's an orchestration within the government to spread this on various platforms. But the market of India itself is so lucrative to tech companies that you often find this content, the policing of this content is either turning, there's a blind eye that's turned, it's willful ignorance, or there are actually demands that some tech companies have made, or the Indian government has made of tech companies that they kowtow to. And so you see India kind of charting this course of when you are a powerful market with hundreds of millions of users for social media tools, how to use that to get your way, to stifle some sorts of messaging, but let others kind of grow, is kind of the big takeaway. And it's whether it's WhatsApp messages or whether it's the type of Bollywood movies that get made by Netflix and Amazon. If there are Bollywood movies that are critical of the Modi administration, we've found that those scripts just kind of go away, right? Mm-hmm. So it's in various elements.
Right.
But now you said, you know, April 9th to, I think April 19th to June 1st, we have the Indian elections coming up. And it's a very interesting hotbed for AI because you're seeing India has many languages. And so you're seeing AI audio kind of allow Modi's voice to be translated into multiple languages that he doesn't speak. So that's a utility that they've acknowledged. You're also finding that there's a full-scale acceptance of AI amongst some political parties to create memes, to create really crazy and outrageous memes that maybe might not be created, but it's a way to cut through the political messaging. Old school memes don't work, but these AI-generated memes kind of do. And so you're seeing now, you're going to see a flood of content, I think, that shows like the full-blown acceptance of it. And then some of these other things that we might see, these rapid deepfakes that come up, and how are these things in the moment fact-checked? Is it even possible?
Yeah. So before we leave, because we only have a couple minutes left, and thinking about, you know, coming up these few months that I'm imagining is something you're going to be monitoring, Pranshu, and I wanted to ask Kat and Sarah as well, looking into the coming months and this coming year, what is one big unanswered question that you have or something that you're going to be paying very close attention to in this space? Kat, I'm wondering if you can start.
I would say the Supreme Court. One thing we're seeing right now is there is this litigation challenging the communication that governments have with the social media companies. And that could really disrupt a lot of the work and planning we've seen around elections and past cycles. And so I'm watching to see where the Supreme Court draws the line to see if those types of efforts to fight misinformation can continue.
Yeah. Sarah?
I think it's proper that we're all talking about the supply of misinformation and disinformation and how it gets made, who's making money off of it. Mm-hmm. But I've been thinking a lot about the demand for misinformation, and why it hits, and why people are susceptible to it and why they want to consume it. And I think that it's not just because people are fully disaffected and sitting in diners in middle America, which is sort of was our 2016 answer to that kind of question. I think that there's something that we can really think about, like what really gets people to believe a piece of misinformation. And you and I worked together for a long time in the media group looking at traditional media. And I've been talking to misinformation researchers that social media is clearly very important, but the way that the messages that surface on social media get translated and amplified and used in traditional media is in some ways as if not more important. And so I'm really also looking at the way these two different worlds kind of communicate with one another.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Well, Sarah, Pranshu, and Kat, thank you so much. We'll have to leave it there, but thanks for joining us today.
Good afternoon. I'm Jonathan Capehart, Associate Editor here at The Washington Post, and here with me, Adam Bree, CEO of, we're going to talk about this in a minute, of Skydio, the leading drone manufacturer in the United States. Adam, welcome to The Washington Post.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So I sort of giggled in saying the company name because I asked you, how do you pronounce it? So how do you pronounce the company name?
Skydio.
Skydio. I speak Italian, so when I saw it, I said, oh, Skydio. And in Italian, Dio means God. So it's like, oh, how clever, sky god. Was that on purpose?
That was unintentional. So Skydio comes from Sky Studio. We were thinking Sky Studio, and you Google Sky Studio, and you get a million hits. And when we were a three-person startup, there was no way we were going to be at the top of that. But Skydio was more unique, and we found out 3 months later that it also meant sky god.
Uh-huh. And so are you in the Italian market?
Not yet.
Take it from me. If you go to the Italian market, Skydio.
Yeah, we know what our launch campaign is going to be there.
So you co-founded Skydio 10 years ago, first producing consumer drones and then designing drones for military and corporate use. Talk briefly about this evolution and how quickly was that evolution?
So the big bet that we made when we started the company was that drones can be useful for a really wide range of tasks, but a fundamental limiter at the time and largely still today is needing to have an expert pilot there flying the drone. So when we started, we went all in on computer vision and AI, and this was in 2014. before most people thought these things were cool. You know, we thought they were cool. We thought that it was going to be a really big deal. So the big bet that we made is make the thing smart enough to fly itself, build in the skills of an expert pilot, which just makes it more useful to more people in more ways. And we felt like the consumer market was probably going to develop first. That turned out to be true. So our first products were consumer oriented, but we always felt like the consumer product foundation was kind of the right starting point for other kinds of applications. You know, the fundamental thing that our products do is put sensors in important places to capture useful information. You can think of it like a flying camera. So the consumer platform did in fact turn out to be a really useful starting point for all the things that we do now across a really wide range of industries, you know, construction, public safety, energy utilities, all the way up to national security and defense, and having soldiers use these things on the battlefield.
So since we have this here, so this is a Skydio drone.
Yeah.
And this is the closest I've ever come to actually being near a drone. Is it heavy?
Pick it up. It's about 4.5 pounds.
Huh. And how many is this? How many different types of drones do you have?
So we have a few different models, but this is our flagship drone. This is the Skydio X10. We launched this at the end of last year. And this brings together a lot of really amazing stuff. You know, I sometimes say that drones are like the Mount Everest of technology, but they have every piece of wireless, cameras, optics, vibration, thermals, aerodynamics, and then for our drones, a bunch of artificial intelligence and machine learning built in as well.
So DJI, a Chinese company, it controls more than 70% of the global market, drone market. But in 2021, the U.S. government put the company on an investment blacklist. How has that impacted Skydio's growth?
So I would say that there's two big themes in the market that we think are really important. The first is the transition to AI and autonomy. And with a lot of organizations, drones have reached a point where they've proven that they can be really valuable. You know, energy utility might have stood up a drone program. They've got somebody who's an expert drone pilot who started bringing their drone to work. They're proving that they can capture useful data. But then the question is, how do you scale that? And training everybody to be an expert pilot or hiring expert pilots is very difficult. And so AI and autonomy makes these things more useful to more people. The other big trend, I think, is cyber and national security. And most of the drones in the market today are made by Chinese companies. And I think it's just become clear over time that that's sort of fundamentally untenable for a lot of critical industry applications to have drones that at the end of the day are going to be beholden to Chinese national security policy, which is mostly in opposition to our national security. And so, you know, there's a very strong need in the market for secure alternatives. And, you know, we that benefits us, but I would say more than that, it, you know, we feel a responsibility to deliver because it's important for our customers, and I think it's important for our country.
Mm-hmm. So right now, your drones are being used in real world situations. In fact, there are hundreds of your drones in Ukraine right now, and we have some photos that were taken from a Skydio drone in Ukraine. I don't know which monitor right behind us. Can you explain what we're looking at?
Yeah, so this is work that we've done with USAID in collaboration with Ukraine's Office of Prosecutor General. And it turns out over the last few months, Skydio drones have really become a critical tool for documenting Russian war crimes. So we have a product called 3D Scan, where you basically just tell the drone, here's the thing that I want to create a digital copy of, and it will go off and do it. And at this point, they've scanned over 100 civilian structures that have been attacked by the Russians, and they're using it to basically gather evidence and make a case. And within the last couple of weeks, they've gotten a couple of indictments in the International Criminal Court based on evidence collected with our drones. So this is just one application, but I think that I was actually in Ukraine 2 weeks ago. It's really a window into the future when it comes to drone use. I think it's very clearly the future of conflict and war, but I think that it's also the future for other industries because the stakes are so high there, they have to use drones. And on the front lines, they don't do anything without putting a drone in the air. They're using them to find targets. They're using them to keep their own troops safe. They're using them at just massive, massive scale, consuming 10,000 plus drones a month.
So as we were showing the pictures there, everyone noticed that we stopped on this one particular picture, and this one looks very different from all the other ones. Can you explain what we're looking at here?
Yeah, I mean, so this was a civilian structure that was attacked by the Russians, and basically they're using, this is a 3D model that was created. So the drone went out and captured hundreds of photos of the structure. And then there's a software process called photogrammetry where those photos are stitched together to create a metric 3D model that you can use to take measurements, you can use to capture different angles. And so in their case, they're using it to figure out what kind of munitions were used, which angle those munitions came in from as part of building a case. And it's actually worth noting that this kind of thing is a major use case for public safety agencies in the US. They use these things for crime and accident scene documentation. This is just a very, very high stakes and really tragic example.
So as you just mentioned a moment ago, you were in Ukraine. What's your takeaway after having seen the front lines and how your drones are being used in person?
So as I said, I think it's really a window into the future, and I think it unfortunately highlights this tension and the necessity of having secure alternatives to Chinese drones. So the Ukrainians are still heavily dependent on Chinese drones. They're using, and Chinese drone technology, they're still using them at massive, massive scale, but it's a super fragile dependency because these drones and the companies that make them are ultimately hostile to their interests. So you know, China has put in place export controls to try to make it harder for the Ukrainians to get these drones. The companies themselves have put in place firmware things that make them less useful to the Ukrainians, so they constantly have to hack the firmware to get them to do what they need. I see this as just a significant challenge to us and the rest of the U.S. industry to step up our game and deliver products that are useful for them. And you know, the impact isn't zero today, but it's not as much as it should be. And this is becoming a major, major focus for myself and Scottio. You know, we've delivered thousands of our drones to the US and Western allies, but where it matters most on the battlefield in Ukraine, I think that's the proving ground, and that's really what we need to be focused on, both for their sake, but I think ultimately for ours as well.
You know, so this drone here and the drones that are being used in Ukraine are, as you mentioned before, being used to, in addition to all the other things you talked about, document war crimes. But there are other drones that are being used as weapons of war. And yeah. America has a storied history with the use of armed drones to kill enemies in foreign countries. How do you reconcile the products you're developing with the moral and ethical concerns of drone warfare?
Yeah, it's a great question and something that we think a lot about. So the Ukrainians are using all different kinds of drones. I mean, they have like wing drones, quadcopter drones, multi-rotor drones, surveillance drones, decoy drones. And then they also have a category of, they call them FPV kamikaze drones. So FPV means first person view. It means you fly the drone by wearing goggles that show you what the drone sees. And this is one of the primary methods that they're using to deliver strikes now, where you fly an FPV drone, you put a munition on it, and you use it to go and find a target. So that is not something that we make. We are very focused on surveillance drones. So this is, in the military, they call it ISR, intelligence surveillance reconnaissance. So our drones are really designed to make it really easy to see what's happening, get better information, and make better decisions. I fundamentally believe in the mission of the U.S. military and our allies. They have very difficult jobs to do, and I think that giving them tools that give them better information to make better decisions is really important, good work. I think there are tricky questions as you start getting more and more automated systems that can deliver strikes, lethal strikes, and this is something that the world is going to have to grapple with. It's not something that we're focused on because we're focused on the information gathering drones, but that is still part of the kill chain. I mean, that's part of the equation of having these automated systems. And it's something that we're getting increasingly thoughtful about as a company, but we're not alone in it. I mean, the US military thinks about this stuff a lot, and they're increasingly refining their policies around weapon systems and weapon systems with AI. And I think it's going to be a project for the world really to grapple with.
So Adam, let's talk about police departments. You work with police departments across the United States. Explain how drones are being used in those departments.
So they're used for all kinds of things. I mentioned crime and accident scene documentation. If you have a crash on a highway, it could take 3 or 4 hours using conventional methods for somebody on the ground to walk around and perform all the measurements that they need to gather the evidence that they care about. With a drone, you can do that in 20 minutes. You can clear the crash scene faster. It's just, you know, it's a phenomenal thing for everybody. They're used for search and rescue missions. I think we're seeing a search and rescue mission sort of training exercise here with Oklahoma City PD using one of our drones.
Hold on. Are those voices coming from the video, or is something happening outside? Okay, it's coming from the video.
Yeah. We could probably turn off the audio on the video.
But, go ahead. Sorry, Adam.
But they're also used in the highest stakes scenario. You know, you might have a situation where you have an armed suspect loose in a neighborhood, and conventionally you'd have officers on an 8-hour manhunt going door to door, guns drawn, looking for something that somebody that could be dangerous. And we have examples in our customer base, increasingly on a daily basis, where you put a drone in the air, you can find the person, you can see if they're armed or not, you can guide the officers in. And I think that's fundamentally better for everybody involved. You know, it keeps the officer safer, it keeps the community safer, it even keeps the suspect safer, because the officers don't have to guess about what they're walking into. So the notion of drones in policing, and especially AI-enabled drones in policing, I think can get folks rightfully concerned, because there's certainly potential for misuse, abuse, privacy invasion. You know, what I would say, having worked with a lot of agencies over the last few years, is that our most sophisticated, best customers take transparency incredibly seriously. You know, a lot of them release the footage from their drone flights quickly after them. And in a lot of ways, drones are, it's like a flying body camera. Like, it creates this sort of objective picture of whatever happened. But, you know, body camera typically can only document what happened. Drones can actually affect the outcome, because you can put a drone into a dangerous situation that you wouldn't want to put a person, to get that information proactively rather than reactively and make better decisions. Let's talk about it.
Well, we only have 4 minutes and 30 seconds, can't even go down the rabbit hole I wanted to go down. But what do you say to critics who believe drones enable police departments to behave like Big Brother?
So I don't want to live in a world where we have drones randomly flying overhead surveilling in our houses. I don't want to live in that world. I don't want to build that world. And we have been very proactive on this front. You know, we've engaged with public safety community organizations to release a set of principles that we think lead to the best outcomes for their communities. You know, things like transparency, protecting privacy. And there's a lot of things you can do from a technology perspective to help with this. I mean, the drone knows where it is, it knows what it's filming, it cannot point its camera at things that it shouldn't be pointing its camera at, it can focus on whatever task the officer cares about. So I think there's some technology things that can be done. I think there's practices and best practices within public safety agencies that can be set up and followed. And ultimately, these agencies are accountable to the communities that they serve. You know, there's always some democratic chain up through that. And I think that's a really important mechanism. And the best agencies, I think, really lean into the transparency element of it, which I think is really the best answer. And what we've seen is that the more that a community understands what their officers are doing with drones, in general, the more supportive of it they become, because they can see the impact on community safety.
When you say democratic change, you mean small d democratic change, meaning people have a say?
Yeah, I mean, like who they, you know, like the sheriffs. Like, right. We sell to a lot of sheriffs, county sheriffs, who are elected directly.
So you likened it earlier to sort of a body cam. And we've seen instances where we thought body cams were going to be the thing that solved everything, until we had police-involved shootings where, oh my God, the body cam wasn't working, or the body cam wasn't turned on.
Yeah.
So who, in the end, who controls the footage that the drone picks up? And is there any possible way that we could see the drone wasn't recording in a high profile situation?
So this is a newer product, but I think it's going to become the dominant operating paradigm. We have a capability with X10 called Remote Flight Deck, where the drone has a LTE modem in it. It can be flown remotely. So you can have an officer in a remote flight center who is through a web browser controlling the drone. And one of the things that does is it give some time and distance between the person who's like in the heat of the moment on the ground. You've got somebody who's removed from that, who can be more objective and be a guide to the people who are actually on the ground. So increasingly, I think you'll see the center of control shift from the officers who are like actually on the scene in the moment to folks who are helping them and on their team. They're police officers themselves usually, but who are operating remotely. And I think that separation can be quite valuable in terms of the outcomes. And it's all digital stuff. I mean, the drone is recording the video. We have a partnership with a company called Axon that has a digital evidence management system where the video gets uploaded, tracks chain of custody. So there's good controls in place. And I think that the availability of this objective aerial video is fundamentally a good thing for transparency and accountability of police officers.
Don't be fooled by the clock because it says we have 45 seconds, but I've got two questions. So we're going to go over time. And you've touched on AI technology, and I want you to expand a little bit in reaction to something that retired Admiral James Stavridis recently wrote in the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah.
And I'm quoting here, "The winning side will be the one that's developed the AI-based decision-making that can outpace their adversary." This is using AI technology in drones. My question is, what happens when the country that's developing those AI drones en masse is Iran or China? Do you believe the U.S. is currently outpacing other countries in that space?
So I basically wholeheartedly agree with the sentiment there. I look at things through a drone lens. We're a drone company. If you look at the last decade of drones, there's no question it has been dominated by Chinese companies. But I think the shift to AI and autonomy presents an opportunity for the U.S. to really stage a comeback. I do believe that by and large, the U.S. is leading the way in AI today. Like, the most cutting edge stuff is happening here. And this is fundamentally why we founded the company, because we believe that AI and autonomy were the future of the industry. And we have a technology lead there over our Chinese counterparts. And I think that stuff is going to become more and more important. So, you know, we can't stop other countries from developing it, but what we can do is move as fast as we possibly can ourselves. And I think that really matters. The stakes are very high.
Mm-hmm. So we've talked about the power and possibilities of drones in warfare and public safety, but is there anything that gives you pause?
Pause in terms of how it...
Yeah, I mean...
Yeah, so we watch the Terminator movies.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Will the drones destroy humanity?
Yeah, there might be some like software classes inside Skydio called Skynet. Look, I think that I'm a technology optimist. I think that if you look at what our products are doing today, it's the most exciting thing to me. We're building this incredibly cutting-edge sci-fi level technology, but we're really deploying it to the core industries that our civilization runs on. You know, we're giving it to energy utilities and construction workers and departments of transportation, and they're using it to do things that would be where the alternative is like a person hanging off a rope to go inspect something, or not knowing the state of an insulator in a substation that could lead to an explosion. And so there's certainly things that you could be concerned about. And we try to think through this stuff. We try to be proactive as a company. We try to engage with external experts to help us think about our product roadmap and whatnot. But I think that the impact today is overwhelmingly positive. And I still think we're just scratching the surface of what's possible. So I'm generally very excited and optimistic about the impact that technology is having now and where it's going.
Okay, so I lied. I have one more question because I forgot to ask it before the last question. And you've mentioned this a couple times. And for those of you who know drones and the technology, I apologize for this simple-minded question. But a couple times you talked about expert pilots.
Yeah.
How do you become an expert pilot? I mean, if I flew airplanes, would I be a good candidate to become a drone pilot?
So this is a great question to end on. So I'm an expert pilot. So
an expert drone pilot.
I am. Yeah. So
to be clear.
Yeah. Which is actually harder than being like a real airplane pilot. We could talk about that because you're not in, like, when you're flying an airplane, you're in it. You see exactly what it sees. You feel what it feels. Whereas when you're on the ground trying to fly a drone, you have to sort of project yourself. into it. So I grew up flying radio-controlled airplanes. I took it way too seriously as a kid. I actually won a couple of national championships. There's competitions for drone flying. Most people don't know about that.
I did not.
It is as nerdy as you would expect.
Absolutely.
It takes like years of practice, like anything else. Like you can spend as much time as you want on it, and the more time you spend, the better you get. And actually, so I grew up flying this stuff, and then I was starting grad school at MIT around the time when you could first take radio-controlled airplanes and put computers and sensors on them and write software to get them to do smart stuff. So my sort of origin into this was basically trying to take the things that I could do as an expert pilot and codify them into algorithms to get the drone to do it on its own, and that's sort of the genesis of the technology stack that's in our Skydio drones now.
After hearing that last answer, I really do think you should change the pronunciation to Skydio. Adam Bree, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Hold on one second. Yeah, this is the closest we'll get to TV at a newspaper. That concludes today's Futurist Summit. Whether you joined us here at the Washington Post or online, thank you for being part of a fascinating day of conversations. For those in the audience, please join us in the lounge for lunch. I'll be out there with a number of my colleagues from the Post across the newsroom. So look for the sign, Meet the Post, and we look forward to meeting you. Thank you again.
Thanks for listening. For more information on our upcoming programs, go to WashingtonPostLive.com.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.